Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
Yeah, there's probably still a contingent of Bond fans over there that want to kill me.
Welcome to Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. Your place for resources and in-depth conversations with other game development professionals. I'm your host, John J.P. Podlasic. I've worked at 10 different game companies, starting back in 1989 with the TurboGrafx-16. Over the decades, I've developed games like Mortal Kombat, Avengers Initiative, Beavis and Butthead, and numerous others. I now work for a startup called Level X. But this podcast isn't about me. It's about you and the game development community. So if you have questions or ideas, give a call, 224-484-7733, or go to the GameDevAdvice.com website. I have a great show for you today, so let's kick things off with episode 003. Today's guest, Raymond Benson. Raymond is a veteran of the industry, having worked as a writer and designer for games like the Ultima series, A View to Kill, Stephen King's The Mist, Darkseid 2, and many others. He's a prolific author with 40 published titles, best known for being the official author of the James Bond novels in the late 90s and early 2000s. Note, he's the first American to have done this. Games like Splinter Cell, Metal Gear Solid, and Hitman are some of the novelizations he's written, along with original works like the Black Stiletto fictional series. He's also a longtime musician and instructor at the College of DuPage outside of Chicago. Warning, there's a little bit of noise from the keyboard early in the interview, but it goes away. Okay, let's talk with Raymond.
Hello, I've got Raymond Benson here, who I've known since, I don't know, the early, mid-90s. Fascinating story with his background about getting into the video game industry, designing games, working on James Bond, and then doing novelizations of game books. Okay, Raymond, number one, like, how did you get started in the video game industry? Talk me through.
Okay, well, first of all, thanks, John, for having me on. Good to talk to you here. My entry into the game business was very unorthodox, and it was, you know, over 30 years ago. So it was a lot different then. Right. It was like, you know, the dark ages. I was living in New York City, and in the early 80s, I was had a day job, but I was also working on a book about the history of James Bond, and that ended up being the James Bond Bedside Companion, which was published in 1984. Mm-hmm. But during those years in New York, I had friends who I played Dungeons and Dragons with.
Right. And, very common.
Yeah. And, you know, I'd always been interested in games. You know, as a kid, I loved board games and such. And then, you know, Dungeons and Dragons was cool. And then in 1983, the James Bond role-playing game came out. Mm. And that was like Dungeons and Dragons only in the James Bond universe. By Victory Games. And I got to know the designers, Chris Klug and Robert Kern. And once my book started, you know, getting noted, you know, people knew it was coming out, they asked me, would I be interested in writing an adventure module for the role-playing game? I said, sure, I'd love to do that. And that was happening around the time that the book did come out, which was sort of, it was around October of 84.
Okay.
And so I'd started working on the role-playing game, and I had a literary agent at the time. And he called me up around the same time the book came out, and he said, "Hey, you told me that you like playing games, right?" I went, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, I've got this company called Angelsoft that's outside of New York in White Plains, and they have a license to do James Bond games for text adventures, like like Infocom, what they were doing, Zork."
Right.
Those types of games. And I had a little experience playing Zork and those text adventures from a friend of mine who had a Mac, and he was playing those games. And I got I got interested in them. I thought they were very cool games. I loved the Infocom games.
Right.
And I said, sure, I'd love to do that. So by the end of 1984, I got hired actually to, write and design two James Bond text adventure games, and also a Stephen King adaptation called The Mist. So, I wasn't the programmer or anything. I was just the writer. I was sort of the screenplay guy. If you want to use an analogy for movies, I was the screenwriter.
Right.
And they didn't really call us designers then. It was me, a producer, two programmers, and it's all text, so there was no artists. That was it.
Yeah, kept the art budget down.
So that was it. And I came up with the plot, for Stephen King's The Mist. You base it on the novella, but you have to change it enough to make it, puzzles and stuff that people who've read the story won't expect. And the same thing with the Bond, the first one was A View to a Kill, which was the movie that was coming out in 1985. So that's why they had a license for that. But the second one was Goldfinger, because they wanted to do a classic one.
Right. Yeah. Totally.
So classic. All through 1985, that's what I was doing. And, creating.
Who published those? Was it Mindscape?
Mindscape, that's right.
Yeah,
they published them. Angelsoft developed them, and Mindscape published them. So two of them came out at the very end of 85, and then Goldfinger came out in 86. And my role-playing game adventure, which was called You Only Live Twice 2, Back of Beyond, that came out in 86 as well.
Okay.
So. In the space of a couple of years, I had three computer games and one role playing game under my belt.
Wow!
And this was, you got to remember, in that time, in 1984-85, not a lot of people had PCs. No. I bought my Apple IIc when I got the job.
I need a computer.
I didn't even have one.
Right.
So I felt like I was in on the ground floor of the whole gaming world, business.
Yeah.
But the thing is right after that, I my job was over, it was finished, and I didn't pursue anything else in that field for a couple more years. Okay. I was doing some other things in New York, and I got married, had a kid.
No, yeah. Life events, big stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And actually in 1990, we left New York and moved to Austin, Texas. And that's where the second chapter takes place, because in Austin, Texas is where Origin Systems was based.
Yeah, no, they were huge at their time. I mean, I remember they were like a couple hundred people at their peak, which back then was like unfounded. I mean, it was unheard of.
Yeah, Origin was one of the biggies at the time.
Right. And I think that's why, too, there's such a good game development community in Austin, because Origin sprouted all of these different people who started their own companies after Origin, right? So all these companies popped up with ex-Origin people.
Right. When I got to Austin, that wasn't on my radar. I had this wild idea that I would go to court reporting school and learned to be a court reporter, and that way I would get ideas to write mystery novels.
Yeah, right. It's perfect.
But, you know, I took about 3 months worth of court reporting school, and actually I was pretty good at it. But I hated it. I absolutely hated it. And, you know, my wife said, you know, oh, gosh, if you really hate it that much, you should just not do it. Let's try something else, you know, because I was miserable. So, but it seemed like around the same time that I decided to leave the school, I saw an ad in the sort of undergrad, the alternative newspaper in Austin, saying writers wanted for computer games. And I went, that sounds interesting. So I called up and got an appointment. It turned out to be Origin. And I went and interviewed with a guy named Warren Spector, who is still in the business.
I know of Warren. Yes.
Yeah, he's a giant in the business, you know. Of course, you know, Origin at the time, the head honcho there was Richard Garriott.
Right.
Richard Garriott, known to his fans as Lord British.
Right, right.
And I've got to say, you know, of all the people that I've known in the computer gaming industry, Richard Garriott is the one genius that I knew, you know. Yeah.
That's good to hear. Yeah, it's good to know. Yeah, because you hear a lot about him and you hear a lot of stories and there's folklore and what's true and what's not. And is this, what's the story with this guy? So, yeah.
Well, he was a really smart guy. You know, he was younger than me. He started Origin, you know, when he was a teenager. He came up with the first Ultima game on his own, and you know, started the made $1 million, and then his entire family started working for him.
A little nepotism, there you go. Right. Okay. Sorry, it's getting a little keyboard clicks here. Okay, so then you worked on the Ultima 7 and
Yeah. Well, you know, I was one of the older guys. I was around 35 when I got hired. And, you know, just about everybody there was younger than me, you know, in their 20s.
Right.
Early 20s or 20s. You know, just a few of us were in our 30s and, you know, very, you know, just, you know, a handful of people were in their 40s.
Right.
You know, Richard was, I think, 5 years younger than me. But I guess he saw in me, I hope, you know, a potential that I knew what I was doing because I had that experience doing those other games.
Yeah, you chipped 3 games, so yeah.
And I'd had a book published and all this, so he asked me to be the head writer on Ultima 7, The Black Gate.
Wow, very cool.
And so that, you know, that was my, I guess, my credit. I was my credit was story direction, writing, and
musician, I see in
and screenplay. I think screenplay.
Okay, you have a musician credit though, too, no?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. There was other people doing music, but I did one song, the love theme.
Okay,
that is used in it. So cool. Yeah, and I had 4 other writers under me. You know that I sort of led a writers group. You know, the Ultima. I don't know if you've played Ultima 7. It's a huge virtual world with many, many characters, and each character had to have a conversation, you know, a dialogue that you could have with that character. So, you know, we had 5 writers writing these conversations, and it's a huge world. There's different towns, and so, you know, one writer might have a subplot that takes place in that town, and I did the sort of the overall plot. Richard came up, he had the initial premise of the story. You know, he came up with the villain called the Guardian, and this concept of the Fellowship, which is in Britannia, that is kind of like, it's kind of like Scientology, really.
Like a guild or something? Yeah. Or yeah, Scientology. Yeah, yeah.
Well, they were a villainous organization, you know. So so that was what was given to me, you know, have the Guardian, have the Fellowship. And so I came up, you know, kind of with a mystery plot, almost, you know, I will say it was kind of a James Bond formula where you as the avatar have to infiltrate the bad guy's lair, you know, seek him down into his secret lair and destroy him, you know, find him.
Right.
So, Yeah. So Ultima 7, you know, that was quite an undertaking. I'd never done it.
Heck, if there were four other writers, I mean, how big was that team?
Yeah. Oh, it was huge. There must have been 30 people around that, wow. 30 or 40 people. You know, several programmers, lots of artists, sound people, music people. You know, it must have had two or three producers.
That's a big team for 1992. I mean,
You know, we started it in 1991. So, and boy, the crunch mode was
yes, crunch mode.
We were in crunch mode for 6 months. Yeah. Oh boy.
Yikes.
Well, as a result of that, I started getting other offers from other companies. The game was a big hit. Got good reviews, and you know, the story was mentioned, I got mentioned, and it's not to take away from everybody else that worked on the game. I mean, everybody contributed a great deal to the game. But I did start getting offers, and one was from MicroProse in Hunt Valley, Maryland.
Yeah, I love their simulations. For people that don't know, they were very, very much in like military and driving sims.
Yeah, yeah.
There was an F1 game I used to play there.
Yeah, Civilization was one of their
Civilization, videos. Obviously, too. Yeah,
and that was made by Sid Meier, who I guess I could say he's a genius too.
Sid Meier
was pretty great.
Yeah.
But anyway, I went up to him. I said, "What the heck?" You know, they were offering more money, so I went up and interviewed, and I got the job. And this time, I would be a full-fledged designer rather than a writer. So I moved my family cross-country from Austin, Texas, to the Baltimore area. We lived in Towson,
right?
And I worked for MicroProse, and they had a new division that was doing what they called graphic adventures, and these were, you know, if you took the text adventures of the 80s and then put graphics on them,
right,
that's what they were. You know, so you played a little guy that walked around and, you know, was basically in a story, almost, you know, an interactive movie, so to speak.
Right.
And you solve puzzles and it tells a story. So that's exactly what I like to do.
Yeah.
So the game I did there was called Return of the Phantom, which was a sequel to Phantom of the Opera.
Ah, okay.
And, you know, again, we had a big team. We had great artists. We had good programmers. But I did, you know, I was the writer designer for that one. Matt Grusin, who is still in the business, was the producer. And he was a great guy, too. Then, MicroProse had some problems. And financial problems, and they had to start laying off, you know, a lot of people.
Yeah.
And our whole division got laid off. So, and that included me.
Yeah, I've been through that. We've been through that. I've been through that solo and with you at Viacom. So, yeah, I know that.
Well, and that's one thing I want to say about this business is that it is very volatile. And for, you know, consider that just a cautionary aside for anybody who wants to get into the business, you know, be prepared to not be in one place for the rest of your life.
Right. So you were laid off from MicroProse, and that's how you made to Viacom New Media then?
Yeah, but there was a little interim where I did a freelance job for a company called Cyber Dreams. They were based in California, and they had done a game called Dark Seed, which was based on the artwork of H.R. Giger.
Oh, okay.
You know, the fantasy horror artist who helped design the Alien.
Alien, yeah.
Well, that game was very successful, and they wanted to do a sequel. And David Mullick, who is also still in the business, he found out about me, I guess, through a headhunter or something. I really can't remember. But he called me and said, "How would you like to design and write Dark Seed 2? And I went, "Yes, you know, I'm out of a job. Let's do it."
Right.
So for about 3 months there, between MicroProse and Viacom, I wrote and designed the entire script for Dark Seed 2. And then they basically took it and ran with it. And then I pretty much had nothing more to do with it until it came out. 2 years later.
Yeah, that's why it came out after your Viacom titles. Okay,
that makes sense. Yeah, it took them 2 years to create the game, but they basically used everything I wrote and design, you know. So
cool.
It was very well managed as far as that, and as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. So a headhunter got me in touch with Viacom New Media, and I started there at the beginning of November 93. And immediately got put on Are You Afraid of the Dark? The Tale of Orfeo's Curse.
Right.
Yeah, you remember that.
Yeah, that was Nickelodeon, right?
And, yeah.
I was very much in the world of Beavis and Butthead games, but I remember that.
Right. For listeners who aren't aware, Viacom New Media bought a small company called
ICOM Simulations, and ICOM stood for International Conglomeration of Megalomaniacs. But when you said ICOM Simulations, it sounded much more legit and authentic.
Right.
And businessly, that's a word, but yeah, it was, and ICOM was bought by Viacom because of somebody was on the board at Viacom that had connections to ICOM. And then,
it had already become Viacom New Media when I was hired. But mm-hmm. they were still based in Wheeling, Illinois.
Right. Yeah, that brown building. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. So I moved my family cross country again.
Here we go, Buffalo Grove. Yeah. That's
really. three cross country moves in 4 years, mm-hmm. And started working for Viacom. And while we were working on Are You Afraid of the Dark, over the next year we moved to that big Buffalo Grove complex.
Right. It was a beautiful building, basketball courts, arcade, lunchroom.
Yeah, no, it was not. It was nice while it lasted.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And Viacom, of course, you know, they wanted us to do games that were based on their properties, you know, Paramount movies, mm-hmm. Nickelodeon,
MTV.
TV shows, MTV, mm-hmm. things like that. So Are You Afraid of the Dark was a Nickelodeon TV show. So, yeah, I was the head writer on that, and screenplay credit, you know, mm-hmm. and I also did a song for that.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Some more music credit. And then Indian in the Cupboard, right?
That was next. That was a Paramount movie.
So right.
It was more based on, I guess, the movie than the book. Mm-hmm. But we made a nice little children's game out of it with lots of little Native American activities and games and things like that, and I was the designer writer for that.
Yeah, and that was PC. That's back when games were on PCs and came in boxes. And
I think that was the first Windows 95 game that I did, because Are You Afraid of the Dark was still DOS. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, do you?
Yeah. That sounds about right, because I remember. We made a big deal about being Windows 95. I remember going to a launch party for DirectX 1 at Microsoft. They had Guar Play, and it was at Halloween, and everyone that was on Windows 95 and doing DirectX were showing off their games. And we were in a booth in this giant underground garage, and Guar was there, and it was kind of surreal. But yeah, it was a big deal to make that push to Windows 95 versus DOS, because that's how games always were, and you type in your command and start the game and everything, and now it was, you know, running through Windows 95.
Yeah.
And DirectX and all that kind of stuff.
And I guess, you know, that really started the graphics explosion with games. Mm-hmm. I mean, you started getting graphics in the early 90s, and then but by the mid 90s, and you know, 96, 97, 98, graphics really improved. You got more cinematic with games.
Right. It was going more 3D, and you could do a lot more just in terms of software packages
and the platforms increased. I mean, you started getting actual video games rather than computer games. You know, you had the Nintendo and the Segas and cartridge games, things like that. And so you had to, you know, when you were doing a game, you had to think about, okay, this one's the PC version, and this is going to be the Nintendo version or whatever it is, and you had to like pare it down a little bit and things.
Right. Like that. I remember we worked on Beavis and Butthead on console, and they were different. It was odd too because they were different games on different platforms. So like one developer developed the Super Nintendo, another one developed the Genesis, which was Radical Entertainment that later became morphed, I believe, into EA Vancouver. And a Game Gear version was another developer. So there were sometimes different experiences on different platforms versus other games that they tried to water down a little more and just make it pretty much the same experience across all the different platforms, like Zoop, the puzzle game.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
That was on like 9,000 platforms we launched on. It was a crazy undertaking there. But it was a different time, so things were changing.
And
powerful game consoles coming out. Yeah.
When Indian in the Cupboard came out, Dark Seed 2 finally came out.
Right.
So I had a game from Viacom and a game from another company come out at the same time.
There you go.
It was a little weird. But right. If I had to look at all of my games that I did, I would point to Dark Seed 2 as my favorite.
Really? Okay. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah.
It just had a really, I think it had a really good story, and working with, you know, H.R. Giger that was just, it was a nice experience. I think I wrote a very, I think I was very influenced by Twin Peaks at the time. So it had like, you know, an alternate universes and things like that. Right.
The original Twin Peaks.
Yeah. The original Twin Peaks.
Yes. I remember running home to watch that on TV at night after work. Or set the VCR to date myself. Yeah.
I got out of the blue in late 95, out of the blue, the Ian Fleming estate contacted me. We had stayed in touch since my book came out in 1984 about James Bond.
Right.
And we'd stayed in touch, and they asked me out of the blue, how would I like to write official James Bond novels?
Whoa. Like, whoa. Can't say no to that.
After Ian Fleming died, his estate would periodically hire new authors to write new books. Mm-hmm. And Kingsley Amis was the first one, and then John Gardner. And John Gardner had done it for many, many years, and he had decided not to, he wanted to quit. Mm-hmm. And so they asked me. I had to kind of audition, write.
How did that work?
Yeah, I had to write a plot outline on spec. Mm-hmm. And that had to be approved not only by the Fleming estate, but by the British publisher and the American publisher. Mm. And once that was greenlit, I had to write the first four chapters on spec. And same approval process. And once that was done, then I got the job. And it was announced I was the new Ian Fleming. The first American Ian Fleming.
Right. That had to be a little controversial, right?
Like, it was very controversial.
Some feathers overseas. Yeah, the Brits probably weren't happy.
It did. There's probably still a contingent of Bond fans over there that want to kill me. But I stayed at Viacom the entire year that I was writing the first novel. Mm-hmm. And because I didn't know how it was going to go, you know, what if
we're doing stuff on spec? Who knows, right?
So it got to be late 96. I turned in the novel. It was accepted. It was going to be published in the spring, late spring of 97. And of course, you know what was going on by the time of late spring 97, and that was that Viacom New Media was on its way out the door.
There was that weird, like, do we merge with Virgin Interactive? And I was working on a Dilbert pitch, and we had Star Wars pitches going and waiting to see if it was going to happen. And it was an awkward time.
And there was this talk of, you know, changing the name, you know, going independent and changing the name to Rabbit Entertainment.
I was like, that's kind of not the best timing probably for that.
But all through that year that I was writing the novel, I'm kind of grateful that I wasn't really on a project that had been greenlit at Viacom. Mm-hmm. I was in developing pitch mode. And I remember working on for several months a pitch for a game called Killers. I don't know if you remember that.
No, I don't remember.
It was a serial killer, FBI profiling serial killer game.
Huh.
At that time, Silence of the Lambs was, a big movie in the early 90s, and mm-hmm. serial killers were kind of in the news and kind of a big deal. And I got to know John Douglas, the guy that's behind Mindhunter, the Netflix show.
Okay.
Yeah, cool. he was the FBI FBI guys that invented profiling, you could say. I mean,
wow.
Quote unquote invented.
Yeah, yeah.
And he wrote several. He and another guy, a co-writer, wrote several books in the 90s about his profiling days. So uh-huh. We approached him to be the consultant on the game, and we did a big pitch in New York. And I think they were just afraid of it. This was the MTV Nickelodeon game about serial killers, hunting serial killers.
Right.
I think it would have been a huge hit.
We had Club Dead, though, the alternative murder. Remember that game,
yeah, Club Dead? I remember Club Dead, yeah. But that was more pop arty. This one was pretty serious. This one was about,
serial killer.
Yeah, so. You had to really investigate and find, look at forensic evidence and stuff like it. It was very adults only. So I remember working on that, and I remember working on a sort of a Pictionary type game that was called Rembrandt. And we were sort of in the middle of that when the layoff started.
Right. Well, there was a snow crash game in development too, but that was a different game. Yeah.
Did that ever get done?
No, that never shipped. And what's his name? Neil, the writer. Drawing a blank. Neil Stevenson? No.
Stevenson, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I remember he came by the studio. And, yeah, they were trying to develop the tech. There was tech challenges, and it was going to be kind of like a first-person type perspective. And, there was a whole team working on that. But, unfortunately, that never made it out.
Okay, quick question break. What are your thoughts so far? Do you have a topic idea, a question to ask, or a guest suggestion? Let me know at 224-484-7733 or on the gamedevadvice.com website.
Well, fortunately for me, my Bond novel came out, mm-hmm. and it was well received. And then part of my job was to novelize the current movies that weren't based on books. And at that time, Pierce Brosnan was Bond, and his second movie was in production. That was Tomorrow Never Dies. So they wanted me to write the novelization for Tomorrow Never Dies. And so I let it be known at Viacom. I said, if you're going to be doing layoffs, put me in the first wave. It's okay.
Right.
And they did. So that was it. I left the gaming industry and became a full-time novelist. And for the next 7 years, I wrote James Bond books. Mm-hmm. And when that contract ended at the end of 2002, I just, stayed freelance and wrote my own original novels. Right. I was on the radar of publishers to do what we call tie-in books. Mm-hmm. And at the time, there were a lot of tie-in novels for video games, as well as TV shows and movies. But I got tapped in 2004 to do a novel based on Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell. The Splinter Cell games were very popular.
Yeah.
I can't
they were huge back in the day.
I can't remember how many were out when I was hired. I think only one or two were already out.
Yeah, but they were big at the time. Yeah, they kind of changed everything. It was like, whoa.
Yeah. So I wrote the first two books in that series. Actually, I had to use a pseudonym, David Michaels, because the publisher wanted to do a whole bunch of Tom Clancy tie-ins. And they wanted an in-house pseudonym for all of the books, no matter who wrote them.
Right.
Yeah. So
Dusty Rhodes, what was it? Is
that yeah, exactly. So I did two of the first two Splinter Cell books. And then another David Michaels came aboard, and then another David Michaels came aboard. A little later, I did Metal Gear Solid books. I did two of those.
What was that like? Did you have to go to Japan?
I did not have to go to Japan. Apparently, Kojima, the head honcho there, he liked my Bond books because they were published in Japanese.
Okay.
At least that's what I heard. And so I was on the short list to write the books, and I made a pitch or had to write a chapter or something and send it in. I really can't remember. It's so long ago. But anyway, he picked me. So now the Splinter Cell books were original stories set in the same universe with the Sam Fisher character.
Right.
The Metal Gear Solid books, I did one and two, they were strict adaptations of the games. So I had to follow the storylines of those two games.
That's cool for somebody that's like a fan to then have like another medium to access and like, you know, read the book and kind of get more depth and more flavor into the experience of playing.
That's the point, is to give it to you know, flesh out some scenes. I think I was allowed to create one cool scene that wasn't in the game.
You do this one.
And then, that led to some other ones. I did. There was a game that came out in 2011 called Homefront. And this was created by John Milius. John Milius was a filmmaker and screenwriter. He co-wrote Apocalypse Now.
A little movie.
Anyway, he teamed up with a game company in California.
Yeah, I remember hearing about it because I know there's some technical challenges or some stuff that was going on with it.
THQ. That's what it was. THQ. Yeah. Okay. So I was hired to write the novel based on the game. Mm-hmm. And it was an original novel, and we decided to make it a prequel to the game. Because in that game, it's about how North Korea takes over the United States. The game starts with it already happened. And so my book had this basically illustrate how it happened,
Like, how did we get here?
Yeah.
And then what about Hitman?
Then came Hitman. After that one, I got hired to write it. I wasn't the first Hitman writer. There was one book, I think, before me. Then I did Hitman Damnation, 2012. Mm-hmm. The most recent one I did was one for Dying Light, which is a zombie game. And I did Dying Light Nightmare Row, which again is a prequel to the first game, Dying Light.
Okay.
Once I left Viacom, the next 10 years, the technical, complexity.
Yeah. Right, production values and all this
just went, through the roof.
Yeah.
I didn't play games as much as I did in the 80s and 90s. Once I became a writer, I guess you could say I lost interest in trying to play games because I was too busy writing books.
You had that, and that was your craft, and you wanted to be the best at that. So you focused on that. And I think it's cool that there was this other kind of career you carved out, writing, and then writing with, for video game novelizations, and having that, that connection still back to the industry and doing cool stuff, in the industry, but, purely from a writing standpoint, which is, it's kind of nice, right?
And I would still do that. If another game company came and wanted me to write a book based on the game, I'd be interested, depending on the game.
All right, Epic, you hear that? And Activision, Call of Duty, all those things. Right.
But, when I look back at the gaming career, I mean, my whole career, I started off in theater. I was a theater major, and I spent the first 10 years of my life, in New York directing off Broadway and, one off Broadway show and doing music and stuff like that. And I sort of fell into the game industry. And so then my career kind of took a sharp left turn into the gaming industry.
Right.
And I kind of walked away, I had kind of kept my toe in theater a little bit, but eventually I kind of left that behind. Then I had the gaming 10 years, 12 years, and then became a novelist. So, my career, I call it the long and winding road.
yeah. Like different chapters, right?
So yeah, exactly. But, you know, I like to say, well, I was back in the old days of the games when games were just words on a screen. You know, you are in a forest and you see a sword on the ground and a path to the right. What do you do? Pick up the sword, you know?
right. ICOM Simulations, back before the Viacom acquisition, I wasn't there or involved at that point, but they did a lot of those type of games. You know, was it like Deja Vu?
Mm-hmm. I still love the Infocom games. I think, you know, Zork and its various incarnations, and that was quite a company, I thought. I thought they were very clever, and you had to be, you know, they were tough. They were tough games. You could, you know, spend a month or two playing one of those games, trying to figure them out. And they were addictive, and they appealed to me because they were more like interactive novels on a computer.
Those are still classics. Like people go back, you know, look on YouTube and Google, you know, those old games, because that's the roots, especially for the more narrative, you know, not console type stuff, but the more story driven type of things. Game. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's some of the early stuff. You know, is there anything you wish you had known kind of when you started in the game industry?
Well, I learned how to do coding, you know, use code, I guess is what they called it. It wasn't really programming, but it was the sort of like if else statements.
And
that's kind of how you wrote your scripts. That's how the dialogue was done, especially
branching.
Branching and things like that. So I learned how to do that, but I guess it would have been nice to have learned a little rudimentary programming, how to do that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And nowadays, you know, there's free engines out there and you can download Unity and learn how to do stuff, you know, coding and C# and all that kind of stuff. So the barrier of entry is low. And all it takes is passion and interest and watching videos. And
but it seemed like the big groundbreaking games, though, were always new engines. You know, they came up with a new way to do something.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the evolution of the Ultima games, you know, from between Ultima 1 and, you know, Ultima Online, which was, you know, number 10, I think. I don't know. I can't remember.
Yeah.
I mean, the leap forward between Ultima 5 and Ultima 6 was huge. And then the leap forward to 7 was really huge. That was like, you know, groundbreaking. So, you know, and it's, you know, that's Richard Garriott and his programmers. They were smart guys.
Yeah, no, it's pretty amazing to see that, you know, a franchise lasts that long and go online and do all that. Because that was a big deal, too, at the time when Ultima Online came out. And that was pre, you know, World of Warcraft and all that kind of stuff. And there are a lot of critics too that were, you know, there's always a lot of snide and snarkiness and stuff like that. But yeah, it was pretty revolutionary at the time to put that universe online.
Right. Yeah. And of course, Origin was eventually bought by Electronic Arts. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how many companies have been around?
EA does buy a lot of good ones. Yeah. They don't always last, but yeah, Bullfrog, you know, and Origin, stuff like that. Yeah. What are you curious about right now? Like, what are you doing? What kind of stuff excites you? What kind of projects are you working on?
Well, I had two novels come out within the last year. They're original novels. The Secrets on Chicory Lane came out October 2017. And that's a standalone mystery about with a coming of age story, really. Then I had one in May of this year called In the Hush of the Night. It's an FBI procedural thriller it takes place in Chicago, about human trafficking. It's a human trafficking case. I have another novel that I have completed and has been submitted called Blues in the Dark, which is a mystery and a tale of old Hollywood. It takes place both in the present and in the 1940s. And that's where I'm at right now. I'm sort of between projects. I'm just now starting to research.
What about
let me ask you this.
Go ahead.
You're still in the business, right? Are there still the you know, when you mentioned Telltale, And there was a big controversy about, you know, the crunch mode and people working overtime and all that stuff. Is that still part of the culture?
It is getting better. And it is in some places. And it kind of depends what the studio is and kind of what the culture is there. I'm at Level X now. We do these medical games that are actually fun and engaging for physicians and very challenging and technically accurate and compelling and interesting. And that's part of the, like our cultures, we work schedules, we try and plan better. We move things around and we try and we eliminate crunch. And I know of other studios that eliminated too, like Iron Galaxy also here in Chicago. Unfortunately, sometimes it still is part of the culture, and I think it's getting better. I think production techniques are getting better, outsourcing and things like that. It just kind of depends. I would bet, you know, when you're still working on the AAAs and there's hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, which is just crazy when you think about it, for development costs and then another hundreds of millions for advertising and marketing, that it's still happening. But the industry, I think, is getting better about it, because I've had more than my share of crunches. And that was part of the appeal of where I'm at now, is we know it's not good for you. We know you have, there's health consequences of it. And it's gotten better because, yeah, it used to be just foregone conclusion that that's what you did. And you would sleep, you know, on the floor in your office or on an air mattress.
I can remember Origin just smelling like a boys' locker room, you know, down the halls.
Yeah. It was just
sleeping bags and in offices and stuff, and just people basically living there.
Yeah. There would be, you know, air mattresses and pillows, and people just passed out. And it was kind of the fog of war, because you would start getting.
And that, that was particularly hard on me, because I was older than everybody else and I had a family. You know, so
older-ish and crunching, it makes it even worse when there's studies, you know, why people get out of the industry. And that's one of the reasons people get out. Two other quick things while I'm thinking of, what's a funny or odd story that you have from working in the industry?
I'm not sure how funny it is, but I could certainly talk about some of the more interesting things. And, you know, working for Viacom, one of the cool perks was getting to go to, say, Universal Studios in Florida, to the actual Nickelodeon studio, and going on the set and stuff. And when we did Indian in the Cupboard, we flew to LA and went to the actual set of Indian in the Cupboard, walked around on it. Cool. That was awesome. You know, for Are You Afraid of the Dark, we got to actually use the actors from the show in video clips that were in the game. And so, you know, we wrote scripts for them, and that was, you know, that was all memorable. I remember Kathy Tutillian and I going to Kathy. New York to, she was a great artist at Viacom. I worked with her on
fantastic artist
both of the games that I did there. We went to New York to research Native Americans, the Iroquois, for Indian in the Cupboard. And we went through the Museum of Natural History and another museum, can't remember now, a Native American museum. And then, you know, we went to Phoenix, Arizona to shoot actors to rotoscope Native American actors so that they would appear, you know, get their voices is what we did. Okay. And that was fun. You know, it was like casting, it was like doing theater again. So I felt like I was, you know, back in theater and directing plays again. So yeah. I really, really liked that part, that aspect.
I worked on Beavis and Butthead stuff for a while, and we had multiple games coming out with a line called Cheap Clicks. It was the $20 PC game, and we need lines from Mike Judge. And at the time, it was the best arrangement he had with Viacom MTV, and he had left and started this little show called King of the Hill. And he was out, you know, in the LA area, and I had to fly out there, and we recorded him somewhere in Santa Monica. Yeah, it was Santa Monica recording studio. Really nice guy. Somebody had double booked a session, and there were people from Japan that wanted to do the session at the same time. So I let him do that first. And then he did all these different lines for the Beavis and Butthead game, and he brought his own mic. It was a really cool guy, and it was fun to hang out in a recording studio with Mike Judge for a little bit. When he did Cornholio, he kind of walked behind the console or off to the side where you could see from the console looking through the window and to get into character. So that was kind of funny when he did the Cornholio takes. But yeah, those kind of things were interesting. Plus, of course, when we had to go to Viacom at the corporate headquarters here at 1515 Broadway, right in the heart of Times Square.
Right? Yeah, right. Did that a lot.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, you know, just off Broadway, there was a bar called Jimmy's Corner. He was an ex-boxing trainer. I remember putting him in the credits and abusing Buddy Game. Spent a lot of time there when we weren't at the office. And
well, Viacom was very good with the, you know, the expense. You know, if we had to travel, then, you know, we got good, you know, fairly good hotels. You know, if any of these guys are listening, I want to just shout out to Richard Garriott. I think he helped me a lot. Matt Grusin at MicroProse, and David Mullick at Cyber Dreams at the time. Those were three guys that looked up to and helped me a lot at the time. And I guess, you know, they're still at it. So
yeah,
you know, they're legends. So
no, yeah,
bye guys.
Yeah, so I'll have to reach out to them and see if I can get them on the show and talk.
I can put you in touch with them.
Yeah, no, I'll look into that. We'll have to. Fantastic to have those people talk about their history and what their thoughts are about the industry now. And is there anything I should have asked but didn't?
I cannot think of a single thing. I think we covered it all.
Okay. Where can people find you online, you know, with website, Twitter?
Yeah, my website is raymondbenson.com, and my Twitter handle is @RaymondBenson. And you'll find me, if you just, you know, search for me on Facebook, you'll find both my personal page and my author page.
There's a Wikipedia page up too, so you can find
Raymond's stuff. Yeah, there is. There. It's surprisingly accurate.
You're like, what? I didn't do that. Appreciate talking, Raymond. It's good to connect again. It's been a while since
Well, I appreciate you asking me, John.
Yeah. No.
Okay.
Excellent. And thank you, Raymond. And thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. If you found it interesting or helpful, please leave a 5-star review. I'd really appreciate it. And don't forget to subscribe. I have a lot of great episodes coming out. As always, I want to hear from you, the game development community. So give me a call at 224-484-7733 or reach out on the website, gamedevadvice.com. I want to know your struggles, your questions, and your ideas. Since the podcast is really about you, the fellow game developer, and our game development community. Thanks and take care. Oh, just one more thing. In the future, I'll be interviewing freelance animator and artist Michael Antonicelli, who talks about traveling and working remote for clients, plus turns the tables and grills me with some questions. So subscribe now and don't miss out.